sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to the 16th Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Today I have an interview with the totally amazing science fiction author Robert J. Sawyer, who incidentally I'm giving away autographed copies of his books to some of the subscribers to the show. If you subscribe and kick in $6 towards the running costs of the show, you too can be in the running to win a copy of one of his books. And I love this guy. He's the most amazing author. Well, I'll stop gushing like a schoolgirl now, and let's get on with the interview. Well, thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Rob Sawyer.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. So, you're a Nebula Award-winning science fiction author. Could you tell me a bit about yourself, who you are, and, well, some of the books you've written, just generally to begin with?
Sure. I live in Toronto, which is the largest city in Canada, and I was born in Ottawa, which is its capital city, in 1960. So I'm a middle-aged guy who's been reading science fiction his whole life. I'm part of probably the first generation of science fiction writers to have come into the field through the media as opposed to through magazines and books. Although I very early on discovered those, my first loves were the British science fiction series of Gerry Anderson when I was very young, Fireball XL5, Thunderbird, Stingray, things like that, and the original Star Trek, which I got to see at least one episode of in first run. It was 6 years old when it went on the air, and the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I saw for the first time when I was just 8 years old, but totally, totally captivated me. It was because of 2001 that my father said, well, you know, the guy who wrote this wrote a bunch of books that slowly transitioned me into being a science fiction reader, discovering the works of Arthur C. Clarke. But very much so a lifelong fan of science fiction and a lifelong reader of it, who got this crazy idea that he might want to write it as well. My first novel came out in 1990. It was called Golden Fleece. I've done 16 novels since then. My most recent one is one called Rollback, about rejuvenation, that's currently being serialized in Analog magazine and will follow in hardcover from Tor Books in April of 2007.
Great. You said you saw 2001 when you were 8 years old. Did you understand it?
No, and that was part of the appeal of it. I did not understand it. And my dad, who took me, who in 1968 was, I guess he was 42, a little younger than I am now, also did not understand it. This was an amazing thing to me here. I was used to not understanding things. An eight-year-old, I wasn't used to my father not being able to explain them to me. He was amazed by the film, too, but as for what it meant, what was happening, he had no idea. And so he went out and bought a copy of the book, the novel, by Arthur C. Clarke, and that was sitting around the house and was sort of, you know, I was encouraged as soon as my reading level got to an ability where I could read it, and I vividly remember having read it at least by the time I was 12, having devoured that book and finally saying, ah, okay, that's what's going on here. It's the only movie I've ever seen that really requires tech support, and you have to read, you know, the bloody manual to make sense of it, but there it is. And I still adore that film to this day. It's a huge influence on me. My first novel, Golden Fleece, there's no question that it was inspired by 2001. It deals with a computer that controls a starship and ends up murdering some of the crew members. And I was fascinated because I never felt that in 2001, or even in the sequel books that Clarke wrote, that we really got a believable psychology for why an artificial intelligence would choose to commit murder. After all Hal had been told to do is don't tell him the truth about the mission, and he decides, well, okay, they're asking difficult questions, best just to kill them, which seemed pretty shoddy programming on the part of the people who had made Hal. Why would a computer that understood the morality of murder still want to commit murder? And that's what my novel Golden Fleece was about. So my career really took us, you know, the springboard was 2001 and Arthur C. Clarke.
Oh, wow. Okay. So where do you get your story ideas from?
Despite the fact that I was inspired by the early works of science fiction, it's always been works of science fact that have given me my story ideas. I'm a voracious reader of science nonfiction. I rely on the magazine's New Scientist, which comes out of England every week, Science News, which comes out of Washington, D.C. every week. Of course, I look at Discover and Astronomy and Sky and Telescope, Scientific American and so forth, and a lot of more technical stuff. I subscribe to the Journal of Consciousness Studies, for instance, which is a technical academic peer-reviewed journal about the science of consciousness, which is what a lot of my recent books have been about, Factoring Humanity, Hominids, my most recent novel, Mind Scan, and a great deal on the book that I'm currently working on deals with what we actually know about why there is any subjective experience, why, you know, mere neurochemical activity in the brain gives a rise to a feeling that you actually exist. So an awful lot of science reading when I was doing probably my most famous work, which is the Neanderthal trilogy, Hominids, which won the Hugo Award, Humans, which was a Hugo finalist, Hybrids, the final volume in the series, got a starred review and book list. Those took me to the annual meetings of the Paleoanthropology Society, where I sat down with all sorts of people who were working in the actuality of Neanderthal fossils to learn as much as I could. So for me, science fiction, the science is what happens first. I get the science from credible sources and extrapolate it into the fiction, but the ideas come out of the science.
Okay. The next question, what would you describe your worldview as?
That's a good question. I love science fiction because I think it's the only platform that actually reflects the worldview that I have, which is a rationalist worldview. I see all around me pop religion and mysticism creeping into day-to-day life. There's an apocalypticist who's in the White House right now who really does believe in a literal reading of the Bible. This stuff terrifies me. Evolution is being squeezed out of being taught, at least in American schools. And I'm a guy who believes in the absolute supreme rational power of the human mind. I think that is the greatest of all the things that evolution has given us, is this ability to actually see the truth of things and develop a rational approach to ferreting out the truth, the scientific method being the best exemplar of how we do that. That said, I don't think that having a scientific understanding in any way diminishes the wonder and joy of being alive and just the incredible beauty of the night sky or of a newborn baby, that sort of thing. So I really look for a way to explore in my books that rational worldview that says, yeah, let's get a grip. Let's look at what the data actually says, but in a way that never diminishes the joy of being human. And one of my novel titles, Factoring Humanity, I think did the best job of kind of bringing those two together, because it is about the hard, rigid mathematics, but it's also about the intimately human. And I love the fact that science fiction lets me combine those two things, the grandly cosmic and the intimately human, without ever drifting off into new ageism or mysticism.
All right. Speaking of factoring humanity, where did you get the idea for that? Oh, well, I suppose, could you tell us a little bit about the story without giving too much away, I guess? Where you got the idea for the story?
Factoring Humanity, I remember vividly when I sold it to my my editor, David Hartwell at Tor. We were actually sitting down over a dinner, and he said, what are you going to work on next? And I said, I've got this notion, and it was just, as they called it in Hollywood, the high concept. What if people could surf the human collective unconscious the way a cyberpunk cowboy surfs cyberspace? And he just kind of said, wow, okay, write it. That was all there was to it. And the notion was really that. I had done a minor in psychology at Ryerson University in Toronto. I had certainly been fascinated by Carl Jung and, of course, Théod Desjardins with his notion of the noosphere, the idea that eventually we're going to build a global brain, and the idea that maybe these things that do seem to interconnect us at kind of a subconscious level, that maybe there is a reality, a dimension in which all of that stuff can be accessed. Now, I don't literally believe that is true, but science fiction lets you explore metaphor as if it was real. The notion of the collective unconscious, which Jung clearly meant as metaphor, What if it was really real? What if it was a place that you could actually plug into and explore? And not just all the archetypes were there, but every memory every human being had ever had was recorded somewhere in kind of an overmind. And the novel developed out of that, and the realization that at our individual day-to-day lives basis, we really don't have much of a connection with other people, and our lack of empathy gives rise to an awful lot of the horror that humans perpetrate individually on each other. There's a subplot about a father having potentially abused his daughter in the novel, but also on a global scale, war, prejudice, and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, you know, what if there was a way to plug into the commonalities of humanity? Wouldn't a lot of that disappear? And that's what I wanted to explore in that book. And it's still, to my date, although the book is now 9 years old, it's still my favorite of my novels, Factoring Humanity.
Okay. Well, I would certainly recommend it to anyone that wanted to give it a read.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, they're good books, so...
Well, the idea, and I always say this, I just got off a week of teaching science fiction writing in Canada, and the idea that I always tell my students is this: you shouldn't try to be blandly acceptable to everybody. Your job is to become the favorite author of a narrow segment of the population. Those people who think that science fiction should have a philosophical underpinning and should reinforce the rational worldview and still don't mind shedding a tear and having their emotions actually, you know, dealt with in a novel will enjoy the work of Rob Sawyer. Those who are looking for pure action adventure, and there's nothing wrong with that, those who are looking for perhaps a pro-militaristic view, and certainly there are those who will say there's nothing wrong with that, won't find what they're looking for in my books. So, the last thing I want to do is get everybody in the world to go out and buy my books, because 95% of them aren't going to be satisfied with them. They're not right for everybody. But I want every one of those readers who would like my books, who does care about the fusion of the intimately human and the grandly cosmic, who basically has an optimistic view about humanity and where we might go down the road, to find what it is that I'm doing. And I think far too many writers don't have a concrete sense of what they themselves are doing and try to twist the arms of everybody in the bookstore or everybody that they meet to, oh no, buy my book, you're going to love it. Well, you know, no book is for everybody. You really have to have a sense of who your audience is. And of course, as Isaac Asimov once said, I had the joy of interviewing him several years ago, well, 20 years ago for CBC Radio, he said, you know, as long as my books make myself and my readers happy in that order, I am pleased. The real audience any writer is writing for is him or herself, the kinds of books that he or she likes to read and just can't find enough of on the bookstore shelves. And that's what I'm trying to do. I'm writing the books that follow up for me on the Arthur C. Clarke that I was reading as a young man, when Clarke isn't writing fast enough to keep up with my own reading appetites.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
I like to think so.
I was also interested in your take on, well, I guess it might be to a lot of science fiction readers, a relatively controversial topic in The Terminal Experiment, when protagonist in the book discovers the existence or sort of concrete evidence for the existence of a soul. I remember when I read that, I was totally, it was a really fascinating idea. Where did you come up with the idea for that?
I had actually been reading, and as I said earlier, I read voraciously in nonfiction, and I was reading just in my general sweep of reading everything and anything I can get my hands on that's interesting, an article about the harvesting of organs, which is a very interesting topic, and I'm signed up to be an organ donor myself, about how they determine when a person is dead. And of course, the problem is that if you wait until, you know, you're really, really sure, I think the body has started to turn and is stinking a bit and clearly decomposing, well, the organs are no good for harvesting at that point. And in fact, when we want to harvest a heart for transplant, we don't want it to ever have stopped beating, because one of the hardest things to do is get a heart that has stopped beating to start beating again. So how do we draw the line between life and death? And this has been, of course, a huge philosophical question, but it comes down to being an important scientific area of inquiry as well. If we're going to say that person isn't coming back and it's time to take their organs because this person here is going to check out if they don't get new ones, where do we say the line is drawn? And I got wondering, and I looked at all the ways in which different jurisdictions all over the world have different laws about how you determine, how do we determine brain death when we have EKGs that aren't sensitive enough to detect any last little electrical activity? Is it just the stopping of the heart? Is there other things that we should look at? I thought, what if there's got to be some definitive marker. You and I, if we have a conversation, know what we mean about whether somebody's dead or whether somebody's alive. What if we could find a definitive marker that would satisfy everybody? And, well, what is that philosophically? It is whether or not there's anybody home in the body, whether or not there's a brain and activity, whether or not there's a soul is a word that's often imposed on that argument. And I thought, you know, yeah, if the soul exists, if there is some spark of consciousness that exists and defines what it means to be actively alive and being human, that should be, like anything else, subject to rational inquiry. If it exists, we can find it. If we can find it, we can tell whether or not it's still in the body. And the novel evolved out of that. I do think that kind of question, and I did a somewhat related novel called Calculating God, which took it as its premise. You know, if we live in a designed, created universe, it should be apparent, if you look at the spine structures of the universe, that it was either built randomly or it was designed. Now, it's an ages-old argument philosophically, but again, it was only a philosophical argument because we didn't have the science to actually explore whether or not the universe had a creator, whether or not there is some definable physical manifestation of consciousness. And I love exploring those kinds of big issues. Terminal Experiment's the one about the soul wave. Calculating God is the one about whether or not we could ever prove, if definitively, one way or another, whether or not this universe had a designer. I love those kinds of questions. I love writing science fiction because it lets me explore those kinds of issues.
Okay. Speaking of Calculating God, I know when I read it, I really, really enjoyed that one in particular, where you've got the sort of hard-headed materialist on Earth, and this alien turns up saying, oh, we're looking for God, and he's going, don't be stupid, and doesn't sort of want to believe it. And it was a really interesting, well, it was a really interesting idea. I've sort of been following the intelligent design debate that's been going on, and he was a really interesting model of a totally sort of a-religious, well, God, I suppose, in the universe.
You're doing fine. You're saying wonderful things about my book, and I'm grateful for them. The point of Calculating God, if it has one, is this. Whether or not we live in a universe that had a designer is an empirical scientific question that is separate from the question of whether or not any particular religion has the right answer. I think almost certainly none of them do. Does any particular religion have a monopoly on the truth? Obviously not. Does a designer, if this universe had a design by somebody who was, you know, the equivalent of an extremely advanced physicist in some previous iteration of reality, does he have any personal interest in us as individuals? I think that's probably the case that he or she does not. But that doesn't mean that the question of whether or not the universe has a designer isn't one that we can grapple with. It's become such a sticky question because if you say, well, you know, I think I see, as say Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal in Great Britain, says, I think I see some fine-tuning and fudging of the fundamental parameters, the physical constants of the universe. Does that mean fundamentally that Christ is your Savior? No, it does not. It means that, well, isn't that interesting that, in fact, it does seem that the ratio of strength between the strong and weak nuclear force, just how powerful gravity is, so on and so forth, might, in fact, be parameters that have been carefully tweaked by somebody who was doing a hugely advanced version of The Sims, you know, making a universe on their computer. We might be that universe to some very advanced being. That's fundamentally an interesting question to explore. And I love that science fiction lets me explore that. The other thing that science fiction lets us do is talk about religion without talking about Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and so forth. We can get away from the labels and the polarization and ask ourselves, well, why is it that anybody believes in God at all, in defiance of course, you know, the evidence? I mean, if the interventionist God that's supposed to be there was supposed to be there, you know, Hurricane Katrina wouldn't have happened, the Twin Towers wouldn't have fallen, et cetera, et cetera. That God clearly wasn't intervening when people thought he should be intervening, and the get out of jail free card, you know, God works in mysterious ways, seems to be a way of paving over our cognitive dissonance of supposedly there's a caring God, but there's a lot of uncaring in the universe. Well, maybe that means that our conceptions of God, our primitive tribal conceptions of God that we still cling to today, make no sense in the face of the reality we now understand. Does that mean that there isn't necessarily a creator? I don't know. I think it probably means there's unlikely to be a creator, but if there was a creator, we can get a handle on some of the parameters and some of the design specifications by which this universe was created. And that's fascinating to explore, and I love doing that in Calculating God. I love exploring in Hybrids, the third Neanderthal book, why it is we have any predisposition to belief at all, this God organ notion, whether our brains are hardwired for belief. And that certainly colors everything we see, think, and do, if in fact that's the case, that evolution has built into us a desire to believe in patterns that aren't there. That's fascinating to explore, too. And again, science fiction is the only tool that lets you explore these kinds of questions. I love writing it.
Okay. It sounds like I'll have to give that trilogy a read. I haven't got around to reading it yet. I was actually...
I recommend it highly. The first one, as I say, won the Hugo Award for Best Novel of the Year, Hominids. So others seem to think it has merit as well. And it very much explores this question because, remember I said, everything comes out of science for me. I went to anthropology conferences and read everything we knew about Neanderthals versus modern humans. And the novel's trilogy is about a parallel Earth where Neanderthals survived the present day and we did not, in a portal that opens up between the two versions of reality. One of the things that I learned very early on in my studies about Neanderthals was there is no credible evidence that they ever had any religion. The Clan of the Cave Bear, that some people, of course, have heard of, which was a popular notion in the 1970s, has been completely discredited. There was no Neanderthal worship of cave bears whatsoever. And what we know now is that these two kinds of humanity, even on our planet, coexisted for perhaps 10,000 years. We had religious beliefs since about 40,000 years ago, and Neanderthals saw us doing things that were clearly religious rituals and adopted none of their own. So why is it that our particular kind of humanity has this predisposition to believing in gods and afterlife and higher powers, and another kind of humanity just looked on and kind of shook their brow-ridged heads and said, what the heck are they up to in the next camp? They've gone crazy over there. And that was a fascinating thing to extrapolate through to the present day. A human culture that had never had any notion of religion, of the afterlife, of God, based on the Neanderthal model, and I loved exploring that in those three books, Hominids, Humans, and Hybrids.
Okay. Now, what's it like to win a Hugo Award?
It was the single greatest moment of my career, winning the Hugo Award in 2003. As a writer, as a wannabe writer growing up, I became aware of the Hugos of the 60s, and, of course, read religiously the ones that won the Hugos in the 70s, and was really, this was the hugest honor in this field that I wanted to go into. And, you know, to have eventually actually won the Hugo Award for the best novel of the year was the triumph of my life. I mean, when I won it, I was 43 years old. So not even, I hope, halfway through my life. But I can't imagine anything equaling or surpassing that moment of realizing that the pinnacle, for me, it was Mount Everest. For me, it was, you know, winning a gold medal at the Olympics. It was the highest possible honor that I could attain in my area of professional endeavor. And to get it, it's 3 years now that since I won the Hugo, I am still literally walking on air from having won it. It was absolutely life-changing and just the most incredible experience. As it happens, one of my very best friends just won this year's Hugo Award. Robert Charles Wilson won it for Spin. And, you know, he's been walking around floating on air now for over a month since he won. And he keeps saying to me, you know what it's like. And I keep nodding and say, yes, I do. And the feeling never goes away. It is the most wonderful thing that could ever happen to a science fiction writer.
Okay. That's great. Well, congratulations on winning it, because, yeah, I'm sure it's a great honour. Now, if people wanted to get a hold of copies of your books, where's the best place to do that?
Well, I sell autographed copies of my books directly through my website at sfwriter.com, SF like in science fiction. So just click on autographed copies there, and you can get them sent anywhere in the world, including, of course, Australia. All the different divisions of Amazon, nationally and internationally, sell my books. And my Australian distribution has not been good as I would like, and that disappoints me, I must say. I recently let my last novel, Mindscan, and the one that follows, Rollback, I let Tor in the United States have the Australian rights as well as the, they normally only had the North American rights. I gave them British and Australian as well because they're associated with Pan Macmillan, and that has a big presence in Australia. And the hope was that the books would become more generally available in Australia. They haven't been, and that's a disappointment. I'm a top 10 mainstream national bestseller in Canada. I hit number one on the Locus bestsellers list, the trade journal of the science fiction field in the United States. And yet outside of Canada and the United States, it's a bit of an uphill climb finding my books in bookstores in English. They're all over the world in other languages, Japanese, Chinese, Russian, German, Polish, Spanish, Italian, French, you name it. You can find my books easily in other languages. But bizarrely, down under and in the UK, they're a little bit hard to come by. So I do recommend, if you can't find them at your local science fiction shop, or your local Waterstones or regular bookstore, give a try to ordering them online, either through the Australian version of Amazon or directly through my website at sfwriter.com, and find out what the rest of the world is enjoying.
Okay. Sadly, there is no Australian version of Amazon yet.
Oh, my God. That is truly a disappointment. I place at least one order a week with Amazon.ca, which is the Canadian version, occasionally something from Amazon.com as well. It has totally and completely changed the way it is that I buy books. And I buy an enormous number of particularly nonfiction books as reference and research for my work. There's a lost opportunity there. Some entrepreneur in Australia should start up a decent online bookseller.
Yeah,
that one doesn't exist already.
That would be good. I buy books from Amazon as well from time to time, but you know, the shipping's
a bit
of a killer.
Would be pretty dear. Yes, exactly.
It's still cheaper often than trying to source them locally when they're just hard to find locally. But you know,
right, exactly.
It still works out. And also, you've agreed to provide me with some signed copies of your books to give away on the show.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've worked out the logistics of that. And so they will make their way down under to Australia, and then you'll be able to distribute them more locally down there. But yes, I'm delighted. As I say, my books aren't for everybody, but I'm hoping that people who are excited and interested in the kinds of things I write, real hard science fiction that doesn't shy away from philosophical questions, will enjoy getting some copies through your show or through their local bookstore.
No worries. I'm sure there's a reasonable overlap between listeners of the show and the sort of people that will enjoy your writing. So,
terrific.
Well, thank you very much for giving us some of your time to talk about your writings and work.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for getting in touch from half a world away.
No worries. Perhaps we'll talk when your next book comes out.
I hope so. I look forward to it.
And I hope everybody really enjoyed that interview. If you look in the show notes, there'll be links to how you can purchase Rob's books. And if you're not subscribing to the show, that's fine. Go out and buy this man's works. I guarantee you'll enjoy them. Well, talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.ml.